The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Do you understand how healing works? By understanding the process, we can not only heal ourselves, but understand why. Welcome to the Healing Power Hour with host Suzanne Hill. In our program, we will show you the healing modalities and approaches that you can use to heal yourself, no matter the illness or the symptoms. Now, here is your host, Suzanne Hill.
Hi, everyone. This is Suzanne Hill. Welcome back to this week's episode of the Healing Power Hour. Thanks so much for tuning in. Today, we're going to be talking about the importance of iodine, which is a trace mineral used by many different tissues in the body. Most people are aware that your thyroid needs iodine to function properly, but it's not just the thyroid that uses iodine. Many other tissues in the body require iodine for proper functioning, including the ovaries, the breast tissue, and the brain. Low levels of iodine have been connected to many different physical symptoms that can be frustrating to treat if you don't know that you can actually alleviate these health issues quite easily by administering iodine to the patient. In the case of thyroid disorders, what I found in my acupuncture practice is that there are many, many cases of subclinical hypothyroidism out there that are helped enormously with iodine supplementation. A hypothyroid condition is one in which your thyroid is underactive. And by subclinical, I mean that it's not detectable by the current standard lab tests. In subclinical cases, the existing lab tests will actually show that your thyroid is functioning normally. Now, as an acupuncturist, it's relatively easy for me to detect a subclinical hypothyroid condition without trying to assess symptoms because I can feel it in the pulse. But what I found is that it generally takes anywhere from 1 to 4 years from when I feel it in the pulse for it to actually show up in the blood work, at least as far as the TSH test is concerned. And the TSH test is the main test doctors usually use to screen for thyroid issues. So what do you do if your doctor says that your TSH is normal, but you still have some symptoms of an underactive thyroid? Underactive thyroid symptoms are usually include, but aren't limited to, unexplained weight gain with the inability to shed this weight, hair loss, fatigue, the feeling of cold, dry skin, constipation, depression, irregular periods, or heavy menstruation. Now, these symptoms I've just listed are wide and varied, and all of these issues could come from a number of reasons, and many times people with subclinical hypothyroid conditions only have one or two of these symptoms with a normal TSH blood test, so their doctor doesn't think their thyroid is implicated. Many times I've found that these cases respond very well to iodine. For example, I had a 48-year-old female patient who was fatigued and had heavy periods, but other than that, she felt fine, no other hypothyroid symptoms. So I decided to give her a tincture of iodine test, which is a very simple test where you take colored tincture of iodine that's dark brown, and you can get it at any kind of drugstore, Duane Reade, CVS, or so forth. We used to take it as kids and put it on cuts and scrapes when I was a kid, so they wouldn't get infected. Anyway, you take this colored tincture of iodine and paint a spot on each of the inner arms and the inner legs that's about the size of a 50-cent piece, and you check to see if the spots remain visible on the skin for at least 24 hours without showering, of course. If the spots disappear before the 24 hours is up, and certainly before 12 hours is up, you most likely have an iodine deficiency. So we did this test on my patient, and the spots disappeared within 8 hours. So I had her supplement with something called Lugol's solution, which is a liquid combination of both iodine and iodide. And within 2 months, she experienced a normal period without the heavy bleeding, and her energy was much better. Just as a side note, but an important one, whenever you supplement with iodine, you also need to take selenium to make sure that you don't get iodine toxicity. To give you one more example, iodine deficiency is often connected with fibrocystic breasts. I once had a patient come to me about 4 years ago concerned with a lump in her breast. She did have fibrocystic breast disease. And for those of you who aren't familiar with this condition, fibrocystic breast disease is a condition where the woman presents with lumpy breasts, but these lumps don't contain any malignant tissue. However, it's very distressing for the patient because not only can these lumps be rather painful at times, you also are wanting to continually rule out breast cancer. So this patient of mine was concerned about one lump in particular, and she and her gynecologist were keeping an eye on it, though all diagnostic tests showed that it wasn't malignant. So we did a tincture of iodine test on her, and the spots disappeared within 4 hours this time, so I suggested that she start to supplement with iodine. In this case, we used Atomidine, which is a liquid iodine formula recommended by the Edgar Tacy teachings, and she painted this on her skin every day, and within 2 weeks, the pain in her breast lump went away, and in about 3.5 months, pretty much all of her lumps in her breasts had disappeared, which of course she was thrilled about, and her gynecologist was also thrilled about. So those are two examples of how supplementing with iodine can have remarkable results in helping heal the body rather simply. Now, the reason I even knew to check for iodine deficiency in these cases was because about 5 or 6 years ago, I had come across the work of Dr. David Brownstein, who's going to be my guest today. Dr. Brownstein is a holistic medical doctor with a practice in West Bloomfield, Michigan, and he's the author of a book called Iodine, Why You Need It, Why You Can't Live Without It. He's also written many other useful and informative books that you can check out on his website, drbrownstein.com. That's drbrownstein.com. So Dr. Brownstein is a very articulate and knowledgeable practitioner, and I'm happy to have him on the show. In fact, he's going to come on right now. Dr. Brownstein, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me here.
So first of all, I want to thank you for all your work with iodine and making it available to the public. I have to tell you, it's allowed me to help so many patients, and that's a blessing. And what I wanted to ask you was, how did you first start to become aware of iodine deficiency in your patients? What made you investigate in the first place?
Well, I began practicing holistic medicine about 20 years ago and quickly realized that thyroid disease was occurring at epidemic rates. And the first thing I started investigating was, well, how can we treat the underlying cause of these thyroid problems that I'm seeing in so many patients? And I would try various nutrients, iodine including those nutrients, and I just wasn't able to help people without putting them on small amount of thyroid hormone. And most of those patients got better and things were moving forward. And if we move time forward 10 years, I read an article in one of my journals about a doctor who developed an iodine test, because during those first 10 years, there was no iodine testing available. And I always had looked at iodine as maybe the underlying cause of this thyroid epidemic I was seeing, but it just wouldn't work out for me. When I called this doctor, his name was Dr. Guy Abraham, he became interested in my practice since I'm in Michigan and we're in the middle of the goiter belt and our soil is one of the most iodine deficient areas of the world. And we started testing my patients and finding over 95% of them severely deficient in iodine. And Dr. Abraham taught me about what I was doing wrong with iodine. I was using the wrong form of iodine. And once I started learning more about iodine and, you know, what the right forms are and how to correctly use them, then I started to see the positive results. And it's totally transformed my practice. It's the number one thing that I do on a daily basis is to ensure people have adequate iodine in their diet and in their bodies. And I see the biggest bang for the buck of any single nutrient with iodine by far. And
your book is called Iodine, Why You Need It, Why You Can't Live Without It. Why is iodine so important for the body?
Every single cell in the body needs and requires iodine. It can't function normally without it. And in fact, we can't live without iodine, as our white blood cells need iodine to fight infections. If we don't have enough iodine, we will die of infection and we'll get glandular problems. Iodine concentrates in the glandular tissue of the body. That includes the thyroid, the ovaries, uterus, breast, and the prostate. And what happens when iodine is deficient is those glands are the first thing that starts to feel it. And the glands will initially become cystic. And if it goes on for long periods of time, the glands become nodular. If it goes on longer, those nodules become hyperplastic, which is a precursor to cancer. And eventually, cancer can develop in those tissues. And what are we seeing right now as epidemic problems? We're seeing problems of the thyroid, the ovaries, uterus, breast, and prostate. In fact, 1 in 3 men have prostate cancer, 1 in 7 women have breast cancer. And I think it's directly related to this iodine deficiency epidemic that's affecting our country from north to south to east to west.
So why are so many patients deficient in iodine? Was this always the case, or is it a more recent phenomenon?
Well, I think over the years, people have been somewhat deficient in iodine, and our bodies have been our bodies can function okay in an iodine deficient environment if we don't have too many toxins that actually make this iodine deficiency worse. So what's happened over the last 40 years is that we've been hit with a double whammy. Number one, our iodine levels have fallen over 50% across the United States during this time. And number two, our exposure to toxic agents that make iodine deficiency worse, like bromine and chlorine and fluoride derivatives, have markedly increased. And the consequences of this are the thyroid disease epidemic we're seeing, breast cancer in 1 in 7 women, and prostate cancer in 1 in 3 men, amongst other problems.
So are you against fluoridation of the water? Do you think that's a big problem?
What do you think about that?
Well, I think that if fluoride pushes iodine out of your body, that it is a problem. And
well, I would go further than that and tell you that they put fluoride in their water supply telling us that it'll decrease cavity rates. Well, there's no studies that show that. The original studies were flawed studies, and they used erroneous data to come to that conclusion. And if you look at the World Health Organization data over the last 50 years, you'll see cavity rates have declined in all the Western countries, fluoridated or non-fluoridated, fluoridated and non-fluoridated, at the exact same rate. There's no difference whether a country fluoridates or not. And as a consequence of this, most Western countries have removed fluoride from the water supply. There's only 3 left to do it because those countries have removed it, have realized it doesn't prevent cavities, and there's no reason to put a substance that poisons hundreds of enzymes in our body and causes thyroid problems and causes problems with iodine into our water supply.
So these other countries are aware of the effect of fluoride on the iodine in our bodies?
They seem to be aware of it. 3 of us don't do it right now. U.S., Canada, and New Zealand. The rest of them have all figured it out and removed it from their water supply. And they have no difference in cavity rates that we have.
Now, the chlorine that's in the water when we take a shower, is that also pushing iodine out of our body?
So iodine's in the – if you look in the chemical periodic table, iodine's in group 17, and it's a member of the halide group. And these halides consist of fluoride, chloride, bromide, iodine, and astaxine. And all of these halides can competitively inhibit one another. And what that means is that if you take too much of one of the halides in, the body – it can push out the other halide in the body that's its closest size. Of those halides that I mentioned, only 2 have known therapeutic values in the body, chloride and iodine. Now, fluoride, if I'm wrong, fluoride may have some therapeutic value of preventing cavities, although I don't believe that's true. But bromide has no therapeutic value in the body. And over the last 40 years, our exposure to bromide has gone up in exponential rates. And I think that this is where the big problem with iodine's come in, that we've all become too much bromide exposure and bromide toxic, and you couple that with iodine deficiency and you've got a perfect storm occurring across the United States, and that perfect storm is being played out in breast cancer, thyroid cancer, ovarian problems, uterine problems, prostate problems.
So the bromide, from what I've read, is in somewhere in the 80s that they're used to actually add iodine to bread, pasta, things like that. And then in the 80s, they switched over to bromide. Is that true? And why did they do that?
That is true. It's actually a little bit earlier than that. In the 60s, iodine was added to bakery products as a conditioning agent for the bakery products, so it would flow through the machines a little bit easier. And one slice of bread contained the RDA for iodine, about 150 micrograms. In the early 1970s, it was mandated that iodine be taken out of bakery product, be taken out of flour, and they started brominating flour. And so, therefore, breads, pasta, cereal, and everything made with flour now had bromide in it instead of iodine. And
why was that mandate put into place?
Well, I've spent many, many hours trying to figure that out. I can't figure that out. I can speculate why it was done, but I don't know for sure. But for whatever reason that was done, that was a that's created a huge health problem that we're still affecting us today.
I want to tell you something. When I first came across your work, I at the time was going to three different doctors because I had a number of health issues. And I told them about your work. And the first thing they all said is that no one in the United States has an iodine deficiency. And I said, well, there's this Dr. Brownstein from Michigan who's done a bunch of research, actually. And he's discovered that over 95% of people he studied were iodine deficient. And one of my response was, well, of course he thinks everyone's iodine deficient. He's from the Midwest. If you're a New Yorker, that's not going to happen. Can you speak to that?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you're certainly not going to see iodine deficiency if you don't know anything about iodine, you don't know how to test for it, you don't know how to read a test for it. So that's true. They're not going to see iodine deficiency because they don't know anything about it. But I've lectured to practitioners north, south, east, and west across the United States. I've given hundreds of lectures. The doctors who are knowledgeable about this and testing their patients are seeing people in the same amounts deficient that I am from across our whole country. I've been through Canada and seen the same thing. I've been to Europe, and they're not testing as much, but the doctors I've talked to that are knowledgeable about this are seeing similar numbers that I'm seeing. We've got a big problem going on right now, and again, I would relate it to that double whammy. Iodine levels have fallen. At the same time, our toxic load has increased.
Well, I know that after I read your book, I tested my patients. I see about 40 patients a week, and I did the iodine test on everyone just because I was curious. At first, I started out with women. I thought, no, let me test everyone. And of the 40 patients I saw that week, only two had appropriate iodine levels. So my study matched yours. Can I ask you about the iodine tincture test? How do you read it? Because I've seen various different ways to read it. When you paint the iodine on the skin, what's your measure for how to supplement?
So iodine's a neat substance because when you take it orally, almost 99% of it is cleared through the kidneys and out the urine. So if you have a known, if you test somebody before they take iodine, and then you test them after they take a known amount of iodine, you can just subtract how much comes out versus how much went in and know how much the body held on to. So my mentor
you're talking
and I
about the iodine. I'm sorry, you're talking about the iodine loading test?
So yeah, there's my mentor in iodine, Dr. Abraham, developed an iodine loading test where you take a known amount of iodine and collect 24 hours of urine and see how much spills out and just subtract the numbers. And what we've come up with is about out of a 50 milligram load, If you hang on to about 5 milligrams of that and urinate out the rest, that's about normal when someone has enough iodine in their body. But if you have less, if you're iodine deficient, you're going to hang on to more of that iodine as your body's really looking for it. So you won't spill out quite as much. And there's labs that do that test. That's the gold standard for testing iodine. The tincture test that you're talking about is you paint a small area of iodine on the skin and it turns, you know, an iodine color brownish on the skin, and the skin contains 20% of the body's iodine. So you wait and see how long it takes for that brown color to go away, thinking that the iodine is going to be absorbed into the skin. And if this theory goes that if it's absorbed within 24 hours, generally they're iodine deficient. And the quicker it's absorbed, the more iodine deficient they are as the body soaks it up faster. And then once they get iodine sufficient, it'll stay on their skin for 24 hours. The problem with that test is you're not measuring a body load of iodine. You might be measuring that skin area's content of iodine. But I don't quite know what you're measuring with that because there's been a study that showed that 88% of iodine painted to the skin sublimates off into a gaseous phase and doesn't get absorbed. So I don't think that's the best way to measure it. I would say urinary testing is probably the best way to measure iodine.
Which brings me to an interesting point, because I often tell my patients to request iodine loading tests from their doctors because it is a good way to measure, and the doctors really seem to not like to give this test. Do you think that that's changing in medical school? Are the medical school starting to teach this, and why are the doctors so averse to giving this test?
Medical schools, that'll be 100 years before it's taught in medical school. 100 years, they'll teach that and say we've been doing this for a while, but we'll be onto something else by then. Now, that's not being taught in medical school at all. They're still teaching in medical school iodine's poisonous, and iodine, you get enough iodine and salt, and nobody needs to take extra iodine. That's what I was taught 20 years ago in medical school, and that's what's still taught today. When will this change? I don't know when it's going to change, but certainly conventional medicine hasn't accepted this. This has really been accepted more in the holistic aspects of medicine.
Well, when I suggested patients to supplement with iodine, and I know that the skin patch test isn't so accurate because a lot of times the patches on the inner thighs will stay and the patches on the arms will disappear. And so then what does that mean? So I suggest them to get an iodine test. But if it's very severe, like if it disappears within an hour, I know that they're deficient. And I'll suggest them to supplement. Many of them go to their internist, and the internist will tell them, don't take iodine because it'll put you into hyperthyroid state, which is when your thyroid, I'm just for listeners, when your thyroid's overactive, you can get some symptoms like racing heartbeat, hair loss, hand tremors, insomnia, and fidgeting. Do you think, Dr. Brownstein, is this a fear coming from ignorance, or is this really a possibility for a patient that they could be put into a hyperthyroid state from taking iodine?
I discuss this in my book and in my writings. And before the onset of radioactive iodine treatments to treat hyperactive thyroid problems, iodine was the treatment of choice, and it was a successful treatment of choice for 75 years before this. So in my hyperthyroid patients, frequently I'll give them iodine, which can calm down the thyroid. They might require a little higher doses, but I mean, there's a protocol that I use for doing this. So the only condition that can really cause problems in hyperthyroid is if patients have an autonomously functioning nodule. It's a fancy condition, but luckily it's not very common. I've seen 3 or 4 patients over 11 years with this. It's not very common. And those are the patients that they take iodine, and they can get hyperthyroid, such as palpitations, fast heart rate, nervous, jittery, sweating, you know, within hours of the first dose of taking iodine. They'll have to stop taking thyroid till you figure out what's going on, but that's not very common. For nearly all of the other hyperthyroid conditions, iodine can be part of a treatment plan to help their thyroid recover and resume normal thyroid function.
And for the patient who takes it and within an hour or so feels these symptoms, as long as they don't take it again, those symptoms should go away, right?
That's correct.
Now, what kind of iodine do you typically recommend to patients? Or is it different on a case-by-case basis?
So my first 10 years when I was prescribing iodine, I was using a form of it called iodide, D-I-D-E. That's a reduced form of iodine. It has an extra electron in its outer shell. And in liquid form, this is a clear form of iodine that you can see in bottles. And I would give people varying amounts of that. And that just wasn't working for me for almost any condition that I was using it for. And that's what I was fooling around with the first 10 years until I met Dr. Abraham. The first 10 years of using iodine, I was using a form of iodine called iodide, which is a reduced form of iodine. It has an extra electron in its outer shell. And I would use various amounts in patients to help the thyroid work better. And I found this wasn't working not only for the thyroid, but for the rest of their body. And I would try it on and off over those years. It wasn't working. And then I came across Dr. Abraham's article and started learning more about iodine and learned that different tissues of the body selectively take up different forms of iodine. So there's two major forms of iodine in our body, iodine and iodide. So I recommend using a form of iodine that has both forms in it, iodine and iodide. And the forms that I use are Lugol's solution or tableted Lugol's solution in the form of Iodorol or Iodozyme HP. And those have been very effective, and that's primarily what I use in my practice.
And how do you start out with the dosing? What level, how many milligrams do you start people out at if you're using the tableted form?
Most patients seem to respond somewhere between 6 and 50 milligrams a day. I would say for the vast majority of patients, I start them off at 12 to 25 milligrams a day, which is 1 or 2 pills or 4 drops of Lugol solution. And they seem to respond pretty well to that. If someone has breast disease, thyroid disease, ovarian disease, prostate disease, I perhaps may use more than that, or they may require more than that over time. But I don't just use iodine in these patients. Iodine is used as part of a holistic treatment regimen that includes getting their vitamins and minerals balanced, detox, cleaning up their diet, ensuring adequate hydration, and so on and so on.
Now, 4 drops of Lugol solution, you said it was equivalent to about 12 to 25 milligrams a day. What percent? Because I know that J. Crowe's uses, they have a 2% and a 5%.
So the 5% Lugol's is the full strength Lugol's. And a 1 drop is 6.25 milligrams of iodine. So the 2% will just be, you know, about half of that.
Oh, okay, great. Thanks. I didn't know that. Now, when someone's overly exhausted, does that increase the need for iodine in the body?
Any increased stress on the body can increase the body's need for iodine. However, the biggest stress we're seeing is the toxic load that's coming onto patients. And, you know, I've tested nearly 1,000 patients for the bromide levels. Every patient's been at high levels. And generally those that are sicker or sicker with glandular disorders have higher levels. Even healthy patients have high levels of bromide. So therefore, our iodine requirements are going up over these times, not going down.
Mm-hmm. Now, when I was rereading your stuff over the last couple of nights to prepare for this interview, I was thinking about, some of my patients have very high heavy metal toxicity. Do you find, it's nothing that I personally have tested, but in your testing, have you found that people with heavy metals and who've had a hard time eliminating them, because some people can eliminate them quickly, and some people, as soon as they stop the chelation, their heavy metal load goes up again. Have you noticed that there's a link to that and iodine deficiency?
There's no question there's a link to it. Iodine has a chaotropic effect on heavy metals, where it displaces heavy metals, allows the body to detoxify from them much easier. I, too, have found that some patients can unload heavy metals very easily. Others have a harder time with it. Those others that have a harder time with it generally have a much easier time once they get their iodine status improved.
So have you ever treated Lou Gehrig's disease, for example? I have some patients that have Lou Gehrig's disease and they have problems with heavy metal toxicity. Just out of curiosity, have you had that experience?
Lou Gehrig's disease is not a nice disease, not easy to treat. I haven't treated a patient with Lou Gehrig's disease with it, but I've treated many other patients with it and found those results.
Okay, great. Now, do some people have iodine allergies? I know that some people are allergic to shellfish, and in that case, what do you do in a case when someone's allergic to it but they need iodine at the same time?
So a shellfish allergy has nothing to do with an iodine allergy, and an allergy to radioactive iodine medical treatments has nothing to do with an allergy to inorganic non-radioactive iodine, such as we're talking about. Very few people have an allergy to inorganic non-radioactive iodine, such as Lugol solution or those tableted forms that I talked about earlier. And I've had a few patients over the years, and there's an acupressure technique called NAET that has been effective at helping the majority of them be able to take iodine. I've only had a couple of patients over 11 years not be able to take iodine.
Okay. Well, we're going to go to break now. And thank you for sharing. We're talking with Dr. Brownstein. We're talking about, he's the iodine expert and one of the iodine experts in the country. Thank you, Dr. Brownstein, for being with us. And after we come back from break, we'll talk with him some more.
Opinions, options, answers. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Have you friended us on Facebook yet?
Why not?
Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for the keywords Voice America. Once you are part of our Facebook network, you'll receive daily messages about what's happening with our shows, this week's featured guests, and new happenings at the Voice America Talk Radio Network. And you can add your voice to the always active discussions on our wall. Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for Voice America.
The incidence of autism has increased at an alarming rate. Approximately 1 in 150 children are affected by autism, giving autism the undesired ranking as the most prevalent childhood developmental disorder in the U.S. 67 children will be diagnosed today. That is nearly one child every 20 minutes. Autism One, a conversation of hope, hosted by Terry Aranga, illuminates how right now there is more reason than ever for individuals with autism spectrum disorders and their families to have the best hope for the brightest future. Autism is treatable, and given appropriate therapies, children are recovering. With well-known researchers and doctors, members of Congress, and expert service providers from a wide range of disciplines, Terry offers interviews and insights highlighting the progress in areas areas related to autism spectrum disorders such as biomedical research and treatment, communication, education, and behavioral modalities, sociological and philosophical issues, and legislative advocacy and insurance concerns. Autism One, a conversation of hope, broadcast each Tuesday at 9 a.m. Pacific on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Autism One, a conversation of hope. Through education and conversation, there is hope.
Cancer is not something to be taken lightly, but instead of being talked at by doctors, medical providers, and others, wouldn't it be nice to hear from a host who has worked at the Cancer Coalface for 38 years as a caregiver, supporter for 14,000 patients, and who has had the experience of having a life-threatening condition herself? You will hear the stories of survivors and other people who work in breakthrough cancer medicine. Navigating the Cancer Maze with host Grace Galler will help you with the facts, planning, and grief experienced with different forms and stages of cancer. Listen every Friday at 12 noon U.S. Pacific Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
You are listening to the Healing Power Hour with Suzanne Hill. To connect with the program today, please call into 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. If you prefer, you may send an email to turtlebayacupuncture@gmail.com. Now, back to the Healing Power Hour.
Hi, everyone. This is Suzanne Hill. Welcome back to the Healing Power Hour. If you're just joining in, I'm speaking with Dr. David Brownstein of Michigan, and Dr. David Brownstein is an expert on iodine research, and he's brought a lot of information and knowledge to us all. All of us are alternative practitioners who've been able to incorporate the use of iodine with our patients to help them heal a multitude of symptoms and pathologies. So thanks again, David, for being here. I wanted to start this segment off by asking you about autoimmune disorders, because in a lot of articles I've read, there are some doctors who are emphasizing that it's dangerous for people with autoimmune disorders, particularly thyroid autoimmune disorders like Hashimoto's, that it's bad for them to take iodine. What is your experience with this?
Well, it's impossible to experimentally induce Hashimoto's disease in animals without ensuring that the animals have two things going for them. Number one, they're iodine deficient, and number two, they're given a goitrogen or something that irritates the thyroid. And iodine was the treatment of choice for our autoimmune thyroid illness, including Hashimoto's disease, before the onset of radioactive iodine. I find iodine very effective at treating autoimmune thyroid illness in the vast majority of patients that have it. I have two daughters with autoimmune thyroid illness. They're both taking iodine at 25 to 50 milligrams a day as part of a holistic treatment regimen. My oldest daughter has gone from antibody titers very high to, they were zero. They've come up to just slightly above zero because she got off her diet a little bit. But it's pretty much all her symptoms are gone. And my younger daughter, her antibody levels have gone down 2/3, you know, on this regimen. And I find this with most patients, that it's very effective treatment for it.
Now, there has been an increase in autoimmune disorders of the thyroid. Why do you think that that is the case?
Well, I think it's back to our double whammy. It's iodine deficiency, and then we're exposed to goitrogens. Bromide's a known goitrogen. Fluoride's a known goitrogen. And our exposure to both of these things have gone up over the years, not gone down. And, you know, you couple that with iodine deficiency, you've got a perfect storm for thyroid problems, as well as, like we talked about before, breast, ovarian, uterus, prostate problems.
So for listeners, can you give us a list of where, for example, with bromides, what can we do to avoid bromides? What do we have to avoid?
Well, unfortunately, I don't know if we can do it in our Western world right now. Bromide is used as a fire retardant in many consumer products, such as any furniture that has a mattress, or, you know, couches, bedding, baby mattresses. It's used in clothing as a fire retardant. It's used in iPods, computers. It's used in pressed wood. It's used throughout all, you know, carpets and curtains and things like that. So we're constantly exposed to it. So I don't know if it's possible in our Western world to really avoid sources of it unless we move ourselves off the grid and, you know, somewhere where we're making all our own stuff. now that's not
and
even
what about,
to say.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Suzanne.
Oh, and what about fluoride? I mean, we know that fluoride's in our water, but where else do we come into contact with fluoride?
Well, how about before we leave bromide, let's talk about food sources of bromide. So it's not only consumer goods, it's in our food supply, in brominated vegetable oil and many Mountain Dew products and Gatorade products, as well as other soft drinks such as AMP energy drink. And bromine is, our flour has been brominated, almost, you know, vast majority of our flour has been brominated. And so therefore, breads, pasta, cereal, cookies, cakes, muffins, donuts, anything made with brominated flour has bromine in it. So it's no wonder when you consider these huge sources of bromine that are in our food supply as well as our consumer goods that our bromide levels have skyrocketed over the years.
Is it possible to get non-brominated flour?
It is. You have to look for it. Health food stores have it. Whole Foods has it. Trader Joe's, I think, carries it. But you have to look at the label. And, of course, it's a little bit more expensive than regular flour. But certainly when you study the consequences of bromide toxicity, it's well worth the extra price.
So moving on to fluoride.
Exposure to fluoride, our major exposure is certainly in our water supply, since I believe the numbers are about 80% of the country has fluoridated water. And that's not the only source. It's in juices. It's certainly in toothpaste, as we all know. It's in baby formula or baby juices and we have over one third of our children now have signs of fluorosis on their teeth, which is modeling of the teeth. Now, dentists will tell you that modeling of the teeth is just a cosmetic problem. That's just not true, because not only do they have modeling of the teeth, they got modeling of the bones. If they have modeling of the teeth, since it's pretty much very similar tissue, and fluoride is known to cause weak bones. It's known to cause osteosarcoma, which is increasing epidemic rates among young people. It's a poison that can poison hundreds of enzymes in our body, and it's a known goitrogen and can block iodine, wherever iodine needs to bind to, fluoride can bind to. So, again, one of the answer to your question is that with our continuing exposure to these goitrogens, fluoride and bromide, I'm not so sure. You know, we can't fully eliminate these from our diet, and we can make some good choices and, you know, try and use filters to pull the fluoride out of our water supply, or better yet, stop putting toxic fluoride in our water supply and using non-brominated flour. But ultimately, it's going to come down to probably supplementing with a little bit of iodine and using the right kind of salt to help this whole process along.
Can you talk a little bit about the salt to help the process along?
So salt, you know, I've written a book about salt. It's called Salt Your Way to Health. And salt is integral to iodine therapy, not iodized salt, because only 10% of the iodine in iodized salt is bioavailable. That's not a great way to get iodine in our bodies. And iodized salt has other chemicals in it that aren't so healthy, such as ferrocyanide and chlorine derivatives and aluminum. But unrefined salt, which doesn't contain any of those toxic chemicals and also doesn't contain a lot of iodine, but it does contain about 80 minerals. And unrefined salt is a essential element for our body. In fact, salt is the second major constituent in our body next to water. We need salt with its mineral load to help supply the right nutrients for our body. So I find using salt an integral part to my iodine therapy, and I pretty much put every patient on salt, and I tell them to use unrefined salt, which would be in the form of Celtic brand sea salt or Redmond's real salt or Himalayan salt, and to use, you know, usually about a teaspoon a day for most people. If they're exercisers or, you know, heavy sweaters, maybe a teaspoon and a half a day, and to, certainly ensure adequate hydration along with that.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, because a lot of people are afraid of salt these days, also because of what a doctor's telling them about high blood pressure. And
I call that I call those the myths of salt, and I cover that in my book, Salt Your Way to Health, where, you know, that's a myth that's just repeated over and over that salt causes hypertension when it's just not true. Even regular salt doesn't cause hypertension in the vast majority of people.
Right. In many instances, you can give salt to someone with high blood pressure and it'll actually go down.
Yeah, I see it every day for breakfast.
Now, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the detox symptoms, because sometimes when people start taking iodine, they'll experience detox symptoms. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
So iodine can cause you to displace toxic halides such as fluoride and bromide that your body has to release. And if your detox pathways are not optimally functioning, that can cause problems. And people can suffer minor symptoms such as a little fatigue or a headache. That's not too troublesome to severe fatigue, severe headache, to achy, flu-like symptoms. So in order to ensure that when you take iodine, you're not getting a detox reaction, you know, that's where the salt comes into play. Using the right kind of salt supplies minerals for those detox pathways to function normally, as well as salt helps to usher out those toxic halides, such as fluoride and bromide. And the old treatment for bromide toxicity was to use salt. They would salt the bromide out in the old days. And so what I see with people, if I put them in iodine and they're getting some of these detox symptoms, I have them stop the iodine, up their salt intake, up their water intake, take a little more vitamin C, make sure their minerals are balanced, and start to use more salt. And then 2 or 3 weeks later, I'll have them re-challenge with iodine. The vast majority of them can take iodine at that point.
And don't have the extreme detox symptoms. That's good to know. Well, for all the women listening out there today, I'd love for you to emphasize the importance of maintaining proper iodine levels for optimal breast health. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, 1 in 7 women have breast cancer in the United States. It's a travesty that the American Cancer Society, the Komen Foundation, and everyone else out there with a lot of money is not addressing. They're only addressing diagnosis and the treatment of breast cancer, not what's causing it. And we're going to make no progress on this until we address what causes it. And I say the cause is right before our eyes. And it's iodine deficiency coupled with this increasing toxic load. We've been talking about bromide, you know, during our talk. And bromide is known to bind to wherever iodine binds to. So if you have extra bromide in your environment or in your diet, the bromide can bind not only to the thyroid, it can bind to the breast tissue. And this is where the problem starts coming in, and you start to alter, you know, iodine deficiency can result in an altered glandular tissue. And I call it the continuum of iodine deficiency. So iodine's main responsibility in the glandular tissue is to maintain the normal architecture of the glands. That includes the breasts, the ovaries, uterus, thyroid, prostate. And if iodine deficiency persists for a period of time, those tissues can become cystic. So you start to form cysts on the thyroid, the ovaries, uterus, breast, and the prostate. If it goes on, those cysts can become nodular. Longer period of time, now the tissue starts to turn hyperplastic, which is a precursor to cancer of those tissues, and eventually cancer develops. This has been shown in test tubes. It's been shown in animals. And what's also been shown is iodine replacement has been shown to arrest these cancerous cells and sometimes to reverse this continuum back to normal cells. Recent studies have shown that fibrocystic breasts occur in over 80% of women. Fibrocystic breast disease is a precursor to breast cancer. That's just some benign condition. And fibrocystic breast disease has been known for over 100 years to be related to iodine deficiency. I've treated many women with fibrocystic breast disease with iodine therapy successfully. It should be the first thing that comes to a doctor's mind when they're diagnosing fibrocystic breast disease.
Interesting. Yeah, but I find a lot of people still don't know about it. And what about the prostate for men? Can you talk about how the iodine is connected to the prostate?
So 1 in 3 men have prostate cancer right now. Again, there's been very little research into what's causing this, just research on what, you know, how to treat it. I say it's the same phenomenon going on in men that's going on in women. Now, the one caveat to that comment is iodine hasn't been as much studied in the prostate tissue as it's been studied in the breast tissue. Iodine was studied in relation to fibrocystic breast disease in the early 20th century. We don't have that data with the prostate, but my experience with treating men is that iodine is incredibly helpful for prostate health. It's helpful for men with prostatitis. It's helpful for men with prostate cancer, but it's more important to ensure adequate iodine levels before these problems develop, you know, not just trying to put out fires after the fires have already erupted in the body.
Well, what's interesting is I do treat a lot of men that have prostate issues, and it's an overwhelming number of men, more than you would think. And what I find in them is that they tend to have excess heavy metals. So I usually treat for that, but I haven't thought about it till we started talking and I was reviewing your stuff to also include iodine as part of their treatment.
They'll like you for putting iodine as part of their treatment because they'll get better much faster and they'll get rid of their heavy metals faster with it too.
Right. Talking about toxins and eliminating toxins, I read somewhere that cigarette smoke, the negative effects of cigarette smoke can also be antidoted with the intake of iodine. Do you know anything about that?
Well, when you ingest cigarette smoke, the cigarette smoke contains thiocyanate, which it can be quickly broken down to cyanide in the body, which is a poison for the oxidative phosphorylation pathways in the mitochondria where we make energy. And if you have enough cyanide, you will die from that. You know, in World War II, some of the Nazis took cyanide pills as they were being captured so they wouldn't have to undergo prison and, you know, interrogation and stuff to kill themselves. But the body knows this. It doesn't like cyanide floating around, and it tries to neutralize it, but it really needs iodine to do this. So you got to have adequate iodine to quickly convert cyanide away from its toxic form to its non-toxic form. And iodine has been shown in studies to enhance this body's ability to remove cyanide and make it a non-toxic substance in the body.
So
cigarette smokers have been shown to have much lower iodine levels as compared to non-cigarette smokers because they're using up their iodine in this manner.
Oh, interesting. Well, we're going to come to a close soon, but I wanted to ask you to share some case studies with us because listeners always love to hear case studies because it helps them remember the content of what you're talking about. Can you share a few memorable case studies with us?
Well, Haley was 12 years old when she was diagnosed with Hashimoto's disease. That's my Haley. And, of course, I need a little help from my wife on this one. This was like the shoemaker's kids without shoes because my daughter was complaining of headaches and tired, and she was cold and irritable. And finally, my wife says to me, "Do you think she's got a thyroid problem?" And, you know, it was sort of like, you know, I hit myself on the forehead and said, "Oh, geez, you know, I should have looked at this." So when I drew her blood, she had clearly a thyroid problem. She had inflammation of her thyroid, and I diagnosed her with Hashimoto's disease. I put her on iodine at that point and cleaned up her diet. And what I found with Hashimoto's disease is that most patients do significantly better to pull gluten out of their diet. Now, she was sensitive to both gluten and dairy on testing, and I put her gluten and dairy free, corrected her nutritional deficiencies, and 5 years later, and I watched her titers go down every 6 months when I checked them. She was feeling better each time. Her titers were going down. 5 years later, she has no signs of Hashimoto's, although I just got a blood test last week with slightly elevated titers, which annoyed me. But I use my Haley as a case history when I lecture to doctors on how to treat Hashimoto's with iodine. So iodine should be the treatment of choice with Hashimoto's disease, along with a holistic treatment regimen. And
sure.
Another case history was a lady, she was in her 40s, and Carol was complaining of severe fibrocystic breast disease, where her breasts upon palpation felt like, the best description I can give you, it felt, the tissue around her breasts felt like hard rubber. What I remember when I took karate in my younger days, hitting the punching bag like that, it had that feel to it, like a punching bag feel to it. And it was all nodular and cystic, and there were bumps all over the place. It felt like alien tissue. It was just the worst case of fibrocystic breast disease I've ever felt. And she couldn't wear a bra. She was a nurse. She was having trouble working because if she bumped her breasts, she would be in pain and she'd come to tears with it. She was going to the University of Michigan to their fibrocystic breast clinic and seeing the chairman of the department. And he had tried cutting out caffeine. He tried some medical therapies, pharmaceutical drugs that weren't working, and basically he'd advised her to have a bilateral mastectomy at that point. So she had had an appointment with a surgeon 3 weeks from my first visit with her. So after examining her, I told her I've treated many women with fibrocystic breast disease. Hers was the worst. And I said, I would cancel the surgery right now. Give me a chance. You got to give me 3 to 4 months with this. If it doesn't get better, then fine. Maybe you're beyond the point of no return. Mm-hmm. I did an iodine loading test, which was very low. She was low in some other minerals and, a couple of vitamins. And she was eating a pretty good diet. And I just had her upper water intake, start taking salt, the right kind of salt in. And really, the mainstay of the program was to put her on 50 milligrams of a combination of iodine and iodide, as we talked about before. And she called me up 2 weeks later and said her breasts were already feeling better. I saw her back 2 months later, did another exam. Her breast tissue was still lumpy and still feeling like alien tissue, but much softer and much better. She wasn't as tender anymore. And then 2 months after that, the fibrocystic breasts were still palpable, but the tissue now felt normal. She was able to wear a bra mm-hmm. again. She was able to have relations with her husband, which she wasn't able to do because she couldn't tolerate anything touching her.
Right.
And then within 6 months, she totally normalized her tissue, went back to normal breast tissue. She went back to the fibrocystic breast clinic and saw the chairman and started telling him about what she was doing. First, he examined her and he said, "You feel like you've had breast transplants, that these don't feel like your breasts. What'd you do?" So she told him, and she said that he just kind of looked away. He wasn't interested. As soon as she took a pause, he said, "Well, I'll see you in 6 months," and didn't really seem to care at all.
He wasn't interested in pursuing her success.
In pursuing it. And I've treated hundreds of women over the years with fibrocystic breast problems with, iodine therapy, which has, again, been written about in the literature for over 100 years now. And she had an interesting story where she did well for, I don't know, three and a half years. She calls me up and she says, "It's back. My breasts are hurting. They're getting lumpy again. The lumps have gone away." And this was on the phone. And I said to her, "Are you still taking your iodine? That's unusual if you continue with the iodine." And it was a long pause. And she said, "Oh, my goodness, I forgot that 2 months ago. I haven't taken it for 2 months." And she got back on it and said it went away a couple of weeks later. And she hasn't forgot it since then.
Wow, that's an incredible story. And hopefully there are a lot of people out listening who can share this information. It's interesting. I was trying to remember where I came across this, but years ago, I came across an article that said that they used to teach in the 40s and 50s, there was some poem they used to give medical students that said, "When one knows not where or why, always look to give KI," which is potassium iodide.
Do you know the author of that poem? I know the author of that poem.
Oh, who's the author of that poem?
The author of that poem is a Nobel Prize in Medicine winner. He discovered vitamin C, Albert St. Georgi.
Oh, okay. Yes, because I know that he was concerned that when the pharmaceuticals start coming in and giving thyroid medication, that the use of potassium iodide was going out. And because it also treats infection and things like that, he thought that there was going to be a great loss to Western medicine. And before we close, we've about 4 minutes to close. I wanted to ask you, for people who have hypothyroid conditions and they're on thyroid medicine already from a doctor, what do you recommend for someone like that to do in terms of beginning to incorporate iodine into their regimen? Because, one of the things I learned in acupuncture school is hypothyroid patients can go on thyroid medication and it can get their TSH levels in the right range, but their symptoms don't go away. But at that time, they didn't tell us about iodine. What do you recommend for a patient like that? Since you live in Michigan and not everybody can come to you.
My first 10 years in practice, I would put them on thyroid hormone first. And then my next 10 years in practice, now I correct iodine levels first. And I find I don't use nearly as much thyroid hormone. I'm down probably 70% in what I was using before. And people do better. And it's not a good idea to put someone on thyroid hormone who's iodine deficient, because you increase the metabolism of the body and increase the body's need for iodine. And there's studies that show that 10 years of thyroid hormone use in women increases their breast cancer rate 50%. And it's because it makes them more iodine deficient. So it's really important to get iodine levels checked, to work with a doctor knowledgeable about iodine. And if you're working with a doctor who's not knowledgeable about iodine and he doesn't want to be educated about it, he or she, then I would suggest find another one. Because it's really only going to change when we make the choice that we're not going to put up with it anymore and go to doctors who are willing to learn this stuff and to appropriately evaluate and treat patients with it.
Okay. And do you have any, I mean, do you create any kind of certificate program? I know that sounds funny, but now I understand why people do that, so that you, if a practitioner is looking for someone who understands and has learned your methods, because you don't just treat with iodine, as you said, you also do salt and holistic, you have a whole holistic regimen. How does one go about finding a doctor that understands this?
That's not easy, but they're out there. And look, one of the reasons I've written my 11 books is to educate people and educate doctors and patients, you know, how to improve their lifestyle. And the first step is to educate yourself. And if you're not getting the right treatment, then find someone who will. And there's doctors out there who will do it. Sometimes it takes a little try, but certainly I would leave your listeners with the idea, you don't have to feel sick, you don't have to suffer with illness, and, you know, do the basics. My feeling, the basics is eat a good diet and hydrate and, you know, correct iodine deficiency and then correct other nutritional deficiencies. And I truly think that's doing the basics.
Dr. Brownstein, thank you so much for joining us. For anyone who's listening, you can look at his website, www.drbrownstein.com, and you can see all his list of many books. They're wonderful books. I highly suggest that you read them. I think you can even download them to the Kindle, many of them. And so thank you, Dr. Brownstein, for being on the show. To all my listeners, as always, I say knowledge is power. Please make use of what you have learned today, and much love to you all. Thank you, and good night.
Thank you so much for joining us this week. Please join Suzanne Hill for another edition of the Healing Power Hour next Wednesday at 11 a.m. in the West, 2 p.m. in the East, on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Have a healthy week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.